Well, hello, kinda Christian family. Before we start today's episode, I do come bearing a little bit of exciting news. Not exciting in that you're getting a free car, but still newsworthy of mentioning by pretty much any reputable press outlet in America. Today, after searching the galaxies and scouring the nations for a partner worthy of joining us on our quest for truth, we are proud to have selected the Dwell app. Now, if you're listening to this show, you ostensibly have some interest in the Bible, and you should. It's the best-selling book of all time. It's also long, sometimes very difficult to get into, and well, my version has very tiny letters, which, until I've had my second cup of coffee in the morning, I'm not quite ready to get into. The Dwell app basically lets you have the Bible read aloud to you by your choice of some of the most amazing voices, and it's set to incredibly contemplative music. So it basically renders the entire Bible experience that much more profound. You hear it from our guests all the time. The Bible has changed their life. So why not give it a shot? Go to dwellapp.io/kinda-christian and try the app out for free today. Again, that's dwellapp.io/kinda-christian. Oh man, folks, welcome back to Kinda Christian. If you feel any exasperation in my tone today, it is not because I'm sitting with a man more extroverted and almost as good looking as me. It's rather the spiritual warfare and technological issues we've overcome to be here today. So anyways, we don't have time for my normal superfluous introductions. I'm just going to say, if you haven't subscribed on YouTube and all the other platforms, Apple, Spotify, everything, do so now lest you face judgment. But since we're on a shortened schedule today, I'm going to give an abbreviated introduction. My next guest needs no introduction, but I'm going to give him one anyway. He is the muse of Manhattan, the Baron of Bonhoeffer. He has put the extra in extrovert, and in fact, he is the second smartest person on this call. He will have you LOLing at all his JKs. He is an incredible best-selling author, a syndicated talk show host, listened to by millions, whereas I'm listened to by probably dozens. I would like to welcome Eric Metaxas to the program today.
I'm honored to be introduced that way. I'm honored to the point of almost being embarrassed. Not quite, but almost. Very close. Ryan, now, this is video. Are people going to be able to see how I'm dressed and what you look like?
They are. They will think that you're in a full outfit, though we both know that you are probably wearing SpongeBob pajamas.
I'm at the beach, bro. I'm at the beach. It's all virtual. The tie, the jacket, it's all virtual, man.
Oh, man. Well, let's just jump into it. Obviously, we both face people. You don't know what we went through to get through today. So we are going to have to think through our sponsors after this. But first things first, Eric, the most important question on any show where they're processing the deeper questions of life, I like to give all guests a space to process. But how honored are you to be here today?
You know what? It is. It's a cliche to say it, but words are insufficient. I don't know what medium other than language to employ. Since I can only employ language, I guess I would say there's just no way for me to communicate the Himalayan level. Even if the Himalayas themselves could be shown visually, that wouldn't do it justice. The scale is just something it's not terrestrial. We'd have to go to another galaxy. I think that's as close as I can get with clumsy words.
You know, we can get the Himalayas on there. Okay, cool. My producer informed me we'll be able to crop in the Himalayan image for you later.
But remember, that just won't do it.
That's right. And also, folks, we also are offering extra bonus points to Mr. Metaxas for integration of the word terrestrial and Himalayan into a introduction. So well done, sir. Well, I hear, you know, you've been in the news a lot. You get all sorts of great books. Every time I think I'm done reading your books, another one comes out. And so you're just going to have to covenant to come back and talk again, because I actually just read your Luther biography. I was in a Bible study, it was a debate club that was reading biblical topics. And several of my friends were like, let's all study Martin Luther. And I was like, oh, I know a guy who wrote a book on this. And I was the only one who read it. They all skipped out on the reading. And I came back and I was armed with information. I was like, guys,
I have to say, I'm extremely proud of that book. It came out on the 500th anniversary of the beginning of the Reformation, so 2017. But I actually had more fun writing that book than any book. There's something about the character of Luther. But I'm also proud, really, really proud, that I was able to correct a number of misconceptions about him. It's a weird thing when you're not an historian, you haven't spent your life doing this, but you're doing this research and you find a number of things that everyone has gotten wrong. And you think, how could I be so blessed as to have stumbled on the right thing? And then the excitement of correcting it and saying that forever now people will know what really happened and what didn't happen. So that was kind of fun. So yeah, I think it's more fun to read than any other Luther biography. I can at least say that.
No, I'll say this. I would never call myself a religious scholar, but I just was, and we'll have to save this for another podcast, but I was blown away at my sheer ignorance of someone who, regardless of what side of the aisle in that debate and your belief in Luther's role in history, I found that book fascinating, and someone who is one of the most influential, for better or for worse, depending on who you ask, folks in the world. Right. I mean, it was the world seismically shifted during that period, and it was fascinating.
Well, it's funny, you said you were embarrassed by your ignorance. I was also embarrassed by your ignorance. I mean, absolutely.
That's right. Well, my ignorance is the most viral thing in this pandemic, so I'm just trying to spread it to one group or another. But, you know, it wasn't enough. You did it with Bonhoeffer. You did it with Seven Men, Seven Women, William Wilberforce, and Amazing Grace. I know that I'm probably the subject of your next book, but let's get down to, you have a new book coming out. Is Atheism Dead?
Since this is a video podcast, I can show you, I literally got copies like last night. Wow. So here it is. There's the book.
So why don't you just save us all from having to read this and answer the question. Is atheism dead?
Yes and no.
Okay. Ah, good. See, good marketer. We're going to have to read to find out, right?
Yeah. Well, yeah. Is atheism dead? I mean, there's no answer, because the question is, how are you asking the question? Intellectually, yes, it is dead. But many things that we know are mistaken are still believed by people. I just think that if you want to be intellectually honest, after you read what's in this book, enough information has come out in the last few decades, which I put in the book, that absolutely makes it impossible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. You can be an agnostic. You can say, I hate Christianity. I got questions. You can say anything you want. But to say, I know there's no God, becomes absurd in this day and age, because enough science has come out, and I deal with that in the first third of the book, that it just ends the conversation. And I mean that. I'm not, you know, I can't take much credit, except I took in the information and I said, somebody needs to tell the world what science has discovered over the last number of decades, which makes it pretty clear, you know? So, yeah.
No, that's so, I actually, you robbed, normally I, you know, your books, obviously I put on par with the other greats, you know, Dr. Seuss and my Curious George tomes, but I spent the last several mornings reading Is Atheism Dead? And one, in Metaxas, I'm astounded at the amount of incredible information that you amassed in there. And I took some notes, and I'd love to get in. Obviously, people, you're gonna have to read this book, because there's so much really just honestly great conversation starter. And I love so many of the points you brought up in that. And you deal with the fine-tuning argument in the beginning of the book quite a bit. Yeah. And I would love to pick your brain a little bit on that, because I've actually been a big fan of watching these debates with William Lane Craig or Sean Carroll and Sam Harris. And even if I agree, disagree with some of them, I appreciate just having the conversation. So with the fine tuning argument, and you kind of hinted on this in your other excellent book, Miracles, I've levied too much praise on you. You point out the incredible, just minute tuning that has to happen, just the sheer odds being against what has happened, with everything from the size of our planet, the proximity of the moon.
It is incomprehensible. It is the kind of thing that when you begin to take it in, you're paralyzed. It's like, it just doesn't seem possible. But this, Ryan, is what science is telling us. This is not some Christians. This is science. Science tells us things today that it couldn't tell us even 40, 30 years ago. The size of the Earth, nobody would think, if you watch Star Trek, you watch all the science fiction, that any planet can be any size and life can be on it. No. According to recent science, we understand the magnetosphere of a planet is what enables it to have an atmosphere. I'm not going to go into it. I go into it in the book. But the bottom line is, if our planet were slightly smaller, just a little bit, our magnetosphere would not be strong enough, and we would lose our atmosphere, like Mars lost its atmosphere. You can't live on, can't breathe on Mars. If we were a little bit bigger, we would have too much gravity, so we would pull down ammonia, whatever it is, that we wouldn't be able to breathe. It gets freaky. That's just the size of the planet. It goes on and on and on. There are so many things that are just so. The more we learn from science, the more utterly clear it becomes that there is not a ghost of a chance that all of this just emerged perfectly. The more you know, the more freaked out you will be. And I think that I didn't put everything in the book, but I put enough in there so that people can see we are not getting the facts. The facts are freaky. They point to the existence of God so clearly that I really I defy anyone who, unless you go to some preposterous multiverse theory, you know, people are just clutching at straws because they don't want to believe there's a creator God.
Yeah.
But honest atheists like the one who comes to the top of the list, Anthony Flew. I mean, the man was an atheist for decades, writing textbooks on atheism. He came to believe, because of the fine-tuned argument and a number of other similar things, there's just no way there isn't an intelligence behind where
And you point out, too, that I thought it was fascinating that you mentioned that anecdote that Christopher Hitchens, when asked to make a defense for the other side, Hitchens being the most prominent atheist of, you know, one of them, his time, said that the fine-tuning argument. Well, one thing I wanted to ask, because it makes total sense to me that you look at just the... just even the equations, you do a fascinating history about Einstein in there as well. And you look at the fact that there are any constants, any equations, and order at all is mind-bending. But one thing I do appreciate, Sean Carroll pointed this out in a debate, and he said that fine-tuning, actually, kind of paraphrasing, fine-tuning could be a perspective. So in one sense, if we're viewing the Earth as the center of the universe,
right,
it seems inordinately fine-tuned because life... we're here. But then you look at just the billions and trillions of galaxies and you see so far what appears to be a bunch of empty space. How do we reconcile fine tuning for life with the fact that life is just so absent, seemingly, around the universe now?
That's the whole point. In other words, life is something that flat out shouldn't exist. The more you understand what it takes to create an environment in which life could exist, the more you understand what it takes for life to exist in the right environment, the more you understand this shouldn't happen. We are, to say anomalies is not strong enough. We are freakish. I mean,
yeah,
it doesn't make sense that there is any life anywhere. And it does make sense that if there's any life anywhere, like here, clearly an intelligent being beyond anything we could dream created it. But again, that's what science leads us to. And we've been told science is at odds with faith. That is not only not true, the opposite is true. I talk actually in the book about how it was Christian faith that led to modern science. Now you think, why aren't we learning that in schools? Why do people buy into this canard, this preposterous lie that somehow faith and science are at odds? It's not only is it not true, but if it weren't for Christian faith, we wouldn't have science. I didn't learn that until I was writing this book and I did the research. And I was astounded because you discover this thing and then you think, this is true. This has always been true. But I've been hearing the opposite my entire life. So part of the reason I wrote this book, Is Atheism Dead?, is to say, we need to look at this. We need to recalibrate because the whole culture has bought this lie, and for some reason that's been going on forever. We need to recalibrate. It's simply not true.
Yeah. So actually, I that's something I'd love to dig in with you, because you do such a great job of pointing out all these notable figures in history, and I found it particularly fascinating that Einstein seemed to be resisting his own discovery about what we would look back and go, oh, there is this fine tuning, and he had to actually try and put something in the way of that. And so if we just simplify it down, do you think it's groupthink? Is there a pressure that if you go against the grain, you're just automatically assumed to be a second-rate scientist if you buy into this.
Always. It's not just true in science. It's true in every single field. It's true today in our culture. It's the way human beings work. We're sinners. And so Einstein, this is actually funny because you realize Einstein was not that famous when he discovered what he discovered. He wasn't the Einstein we think of today. So he discovers in his equations starting in 1911 and in the years following, it looks really clear that the universe had a beginning. It looks really clear like the universe emerged from a single point, that it was created at some point in time. Now, Einstein, living in a world that's post-Darwin, science has already bought the lie that there's this biblical view of creation and then there's science. So when science, in his equations, points to the idea that yes, the universe didn't exist forever, yes, the universe was created, he knows it's going to be embarrassing for him. He doesn't want, he says this smacks too much of religion, a beginning, creation. He couldn't handle it. Now, what's funny is if he'd been more secure, if he'd been the Einstein of, you know, 1930 or 1940 or 1950, he wouldn't have been, cowed into disowning this idea. But he was still young. And so he says, no, this is untenable. So I'm going to bake in, you know, he calls it the fudge factor, so that his equations wouldn't point to this. So he does this. But then other people let him know, oh, by the way, Albert Einstein, you're wrong. Your equations are quite correct. You don't need the fudge factor. So eventually he has all this egg on his face and he's humiliated. In 1929, you have, I'm trying to think, Georges Lemaître and Friedman, the Russian Jew, and then who was it? Hubble. They all converge and say, no, this is it. So he has to finally say, I was wrong. And my cosmological constant, this fudge factor that I baked in, is the greatest stupidity of my life. It's a famous quote. And it's because, and I mean, this really gets to the core of this whole book, the whole thesis. People are afraid to speak truth. Even Einstein was afraid to speak scientific, mathematical truth. He knew it was right, but he said, it's going to be embarrassing, so I'm just going to cover it up.
Yeah.
Now, if Einstein's willing to do that, why do we expect anybody you know to say the truth unless they really have real courage or believe God is with them? People are always kind of looking around to think what others think. That's the history of humanity, and that's definitely the history of science in the last, you know, 150, 200 years. So it's really wild to think that science has now brought us to a place where we can see this and where we have to recalibrate. There's just no doubt about it.
To be fair, too, because I try to point out both sides here, this group thing does go both ways, because there was also a time, and I appreciate you mentioning, the church was responsible for so much scientific advancement, and that gets left out a lot. But also, there was a time where if you had a profound, the church has also been on the incorrect side of science and punished people who, in general, who disagreed with that, right? So it goes both ways. This group think does go both ways.
Well, that's
right?
The whole point is whoever has power,
right?
I mean, this is just human nature, right? We know that power corrupts, absolute power corrupts, absolutely. We are sinners. So the moment you get power, it's very difficult not to want to wield that power for certain ends. So the church in Galileo's time, for example, had that power. Now, as I write in the book, there's a whole chapter, I call it the founding myth of atheism. It's not true, really, that the church squashed science in Galileo's time. It's way more complicated. But what's interesting is whoever has power does the squashing. Today, it's the secular scientific establishment that says, like Einstein feared these people in 1911, and they still exist. And they say, if you come up with anything pointing to God or whatever, that's out of bounds. We don't want to hear it. And they'll crush you. And so I think how crazy and how ironic that we have painted this legend of, you know, the church has power and it squashes the brave scientists, when the reality is today it is the secular establishment that has power and it squashes voices of faith. It's just human beings wielding power, whether they have it as part of some gigantic corrupt church or whether they have it as part of some gigantic scientific establishment, doesn't really matter. That's what people do. And the pendulum has swung so that today we have to speak truth to power. And the power is the secular, scientific, and atheistic, materialistic establishment. They have tried to sell us a bill of goods, and now the facts are in, and we can say, just like Galileo said, just look through the telescope. If you dare to look at the facts, you're going to see you're getting it wrong.
So it's interesting. On one sense, you know, I could see this. I love watching these debates and cosmological. And at some level, you just you throw your hands up and go, "Look, this is science can't prove without a doubt God." On the other hand, it sounds like what you're saying is that it's as of now there is actually a lot more reason to believe in a God created universe, and also that you are. And I know you do this with your Socrates in the City, but you are. Interact with and know of, and basically you're saying that there are a lot of very intelligent people who subscribe to a God-created universe as opposed to multiverse.
There's a couple of things I have to say. First of all, in the book, I mean, I don't think you can, you know, prove Jesus is Lord or the Bible is true, but I do think you can prove that atheism is utterly intellectually untenable. It's like talking about the flat earth. If you want to believe it, go ahead. But anybody who cares to look at the facts at this point, it's a slam dunk. It's open and shut. That's the case with atheism. There is indubitably an intelligent creator of the universe. Now, if you don't want to say it's the God of the Bible, that's fine. We can discuss it. But to say there is no God, intellectually, you cannot any longer say that. That to me is proved in the science that we've had to deal with. But it's also proved at the end of the book, I have a number of chapters about atheism itself and how the new atheists in particular, they have really shrunk from looking at the facts. They have taken cheap pot shots at people of faith. They don't really do the homework. They just kind of want to sell books or kind of want to say, I hate God and let's have some fun making fun of people of faith. But they're very intellectually sloppy. And those atheists who did the work of looking into the abyss, what would it mean if there's no God in the universe? Those atheists, almost all, are either deeply troubled by what they see. They're not happy about the idea there's no God. Or, to my shock, to my huge shock, and to the shock of many readers when they read the book, two of the greatest atheists of the 20th century, maybe the two most famous atheists, Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus, both of them, at the end of their lives, couldn't handle what they were seeing, and they both eventually came to Christian faith. Now, that is totally unknown. So when I discovered it, I said, this is going to be like a headline in this book. This is big news. People need to know that, you know, the guy who wrote No Exit, the guy, these guys, they looked as hard as anyone can look at the idea of a world without God. They came out the other side. The people who don't look that hard, like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins, they kind of pretend like, well, we all know faith and science are at odds, and they don't know anything. They haven't done the homework. The people who did the homework came out on the side of faith, which is, to me, huge news. And it's weird that most of us don't know that. I mean, I didn't know it till I wrote the book. And I thought to myself, the world looks like a different place when you realize that Jean-Paul Sartre and Albert Camus, they both came to faith. What does that say about atheism? When the two geniuses of that worldview come out the other side, we need to at least know that that's what happened. And in the book, I write about that because I want people to know those two guys, famous, the most famous genius atheists of the 20th century, they both came out into Christian faith, not just faith in some being like Anthony Flew believed in, but in the actual, you know, as Christians.
And that's probably important to denote too, is that, you know, faith is a spectrum for a lot of, it's always a question, I've had a question of, you know, how would you even begin to categorize who is where on the spectrum? Because, you know, there's a difference between, do you believe in a God that speaks personally, the Christian God that interacts with humans individually? Do you believe in a theistic sort of, you know, creator who just turned it all on and then walked away? I think those are, you know, it's, if you broaden the tent a little bit, I imagine you might find a lot more people. I think what people think is there is this, how many scientists or subscribers of the Christian faith, they might mean something that's personally,
That's exactly the point, is that I set the bar low in this book. Okay. All I do is show that to say there's no God is absurd. It is now absurd. So if you want to say you're an agnostic, fine. we can have a conversation. But I don't think anybody can say seriously that they're an atheist. That it becomes mere willfulness and pique. You cannot really look at the arguments and say that there's a I know that there's no God. It's absurd. Yeah. You can't do that anymore.
So I'm always in wrestling with this too, because obviously I have there's so many people across different faiths and spectrums, and just wonderful people. And the main issue I have had with trying to get through this with atheism is, and I'm going to ask you to play devil's advocate, is there a way, and I think Sam Harris tried to in The Moral Landscape, but I didn't personally find it as convincing, but is there a way to, we all as humans seem to live our lives as if there are absolute moral truths, and we love faith, you know, faith and charity and hope and altruism, all these things that are not provable in a lab, that we live our life on faith, essentially. And I have not found a framework outside of theism or theistic, where it's divine revelation, where you could get to absolute morality and why we should be, why humans should have rights, why we should be nice to each other. Because it seems like if we just evolve that way, then whatever, you know.
But they see, that's actually, at the end of the book, I deal with that. It is just from a philosophical point of view, atheism is untenable. If you understand the ramifications of a world without God, as Camus did and Sartre did, as Woody Allen does, you're not happy about it. You realize that if there's no God, it's not just like, hey, I can have great fun and nobody to judge me. No, that's really shallow. That's the Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins atheism. A serious atheist says, this is ghastly, because if there's no God, in the end, I realize there's no meaning, there's no good, there's no evil. There is no reason for me to do anything for someone else. There's no reason for me to talk about love. It's just chemicals. We're just creatures that were thrown up by the random churning of the universe. It is so bleak that it's horrifying. And so I think that there's no question about what I'm saying. And people who don't want to say that, see that it's a free country. People can't be forced. But I think we have to be honest that that view is no longer tenable. You cannot have morality without God. You can be moral without God, but you can't pretend that you're being intellectually, that you're being logical in how you behave. Your feelings may come into it, but I actually would argue that your desire to argue about meaning and about what's true and any of that stuff, your desire to debate and to beat somebody in a debate, even if you're an atheist, proves that you believe in meaning, that you believe in truth. So there's a tremendous irony here. We're all created in God's image, whether we admit it or not, and we're all acting those things out. So to be a consistent atheist, you would have to just say, I'm either going to do whatever I like, kill people, have pleasure, but who cares about truth, or just kill yourself. I mean, it really comes down to that. And if you don't see that, you're living in, you know, what Sartre calls bad faith, which is another story.
And also, is it fair to say too, that if there is nothing beyond our biological sort of naturalism perspective, I wonder, and I know someone else, I think it was maybe Alvin Plantinga made this claim, but that if everything is just natural and biological, how could we even trust our faculties to begin with? Because wouldn't they all be pointing us towards just replication of the species?
Well, exactly. In other words, if there is no order to the universe that God has put into it and everything's random and accidental, yeah, why would I ever trust my brain to lead me toward what is true? Why would I even believe there is such a thing as true? The whole universe could be skewed. It could be like a warped pool stick. There's no way for me to know what is true, what is straight. Mm-hmm. Why would I think that there would be such a thing as order and clarity and truth and good and evil and whatever? But the new atheists, as I point out in the last chapters of the book, they use that terminology over and over and over again as though everybody assumes it. But you have to say, wait a second, where are you getting this from? And they have no answer. I mean,
I'm generally asking because I, you know, you open the book with a quote about, the secular atheistic regimes, not from you, from, I'm forgetting the name.
Solzhenitsyn.
Yeah, and it was a chilling quote about the cause of all those the bloodshed was that man forgot God. But is there any way to explain, because I always found this a very chilling fact, but from the communist revolutions and everything from these mass, you know, these regimes that were committed mass atrocities, they were almost all secular atheistic institutions, right?
There's no question about it. I mean, basically, I mean, what's funny to me is that you really get, as history moves along, things become clearer and clearer. And you basically have a choice between American style freedom that says, you are free to believe whatever you like. Everybody is sacred and we're not going to force anybody to violate their conscience. And, you know, that's this amazing thing that the American founders put into our Constitution and that we've been living out for almost 2.5 centuries with a lot of issues and problems and flaws. But it's an amazing idea. And the opposite of that, which doesn't include God, also is antithetical to freedom. It means that the state can decide what is true, what is false. And by the way, if the state can do that, the state can decide that you are a nothing and that we can crush you if you don't do what we want you to do. And why wouldn't they? Because there's no God and we can do what we like. So you find that atheistic regimes are just, you can't even say they're just harmful. They're not as good as free countries where most people believe in God. They end up becoming wicked, cruel, demonic.
It begs the question, can you, I would think even if you don't support faith, you would want to have rights that are conferred to you by God, because then a government or whatever circumstances can't strip you of them, right? But if I've tried to wrap my mind around this, you can't get rights from nature because, you know, I look at how nature treats each other and that's, I don't want that.
You're being logical, Ryan. This is what I find so funny. It's like, it's not that complicated.
Yeah.
But there are people that they just bat this stuff away. They just kind of, they use their will in a sense to just, to demand a different view of things, but it doesn't hold up.
Yeah, and if government gave you rights, they can take them away. And that's a chilling factor. Now, that's a very depressing note we're on. So why don't we find a little... Luckily, you don't just tackle in the book that there's problems with atheism, but also that there are reasons to believe in an alternative narrative. And lots of historical... And what I found interesting, too, is you have some really fascinating... research compiled of the latest findings in archaeology some of the New Testament stuff. So walk me through some of the stuff that you were just blown away by.
It is so crazy. I mean, in the science stuff, I think it just flat out proves that science now tells us there is a God. You want to talk about who that God is, whatever, fine, but you cannot say there's no God. But the biblical archaeology, I mean, again, the reason I wrote the book is I thought people need to know this. This is crazy that we live in a world where most people, including most devout Christians, don't know this. And so they're walking along as though, well, this is my philosophy. I don't know who's to say. The evidence is now freakish. It's not just like, well, there's evidence. It is astonishing evidence. So from science, but biblical archaeology, I couldn't believe how many things have corroborated the Bible. Starting in, the 1840s, 1846, they find this steel in Assyria, what was Assyria, northern Iraq. From then, 170 years ago, it continues. They keep finding things in the sands of the Middle East, and they're astonishing. But the most freaky thing happened recently. In fact, literally 2 weeks ago, even less, an article appeared in one of the premier scientific journals of our time. It is Nature. It's a biblical journal. They published a tremendously extensive peer-reviewed paper. 21 scientists poured their research and years of work into this. And it has to do with the discovery of what we now know is biblical Sodom, the place that we thought mythically was destroyed 1700 BC. Who's to say what really happened? It's, back in the mists of prehistory. Someone that I've gotten to know, I just had him on my radio program. He had a sense in 1996 that if the place existed, if Sodom existed and could be found, it had to be where no one had looked yet. Long story short, he looks there, he finds what is a number one candidate for what could be Sodom. He starts to excavate. He gets down to the 1700 BC level and finds a layer of soot, ash, whatever you call it, that is an average of 5 feet deep that covers this vast city. It was the largest city in the area. I mean, for like 1,000 years. I mean, it's an amazing thing. So he finds this and he realizes that this is an astonishing thing, because if you know how things are destroyed, how cities are destroyed, what they found looked unlike anything they'd ever seen.
And there's no volcano there or anything?
No volcano. There's none of that stuff. So they find 5 feet of ash or soot. And then there's two things. Right above the layer of 1700 BC, this is a city that had existed for millennia before 1700 BC. So going back into the 4th century BC, this was a vast city. It exists as a city for, 2,300 years as a vast city. I mean, sorry, 2,300 years. This is incomprehensible to us. For millennia, it exists as a city. It's that kind of real estate where anybody who's going to settle in that part of the world, this is the spot. So they find 1700 BC, this destruction layer. Right above it, there's nothing. For 700 years, they find no human civilization. Now, this is unprecedented. This is like the premier real estate in the area for, hundreds of miles. It's been occupied forever. But for 700 years after this destruction, nothing. And in the destruction matrix, well, there are two things they find in the destruction matrix. First of all, it's churned in such a way no one's ever seen anything like it. It makes no sense. It's not an earthquake. It's not. Now, by the way, these are scientists, secular scientists, who determine this. Okay.
Yeah, nature's not obviously a religious.
No. On the contrary. I mean, it's as scientific as it gets. So they've never seen anything like it. There's bits of bone. There's melted bits of brick. There's all kinds of stuff. They've simply never seen anything like this. What is this? The first day that Stephen Collins, who discovered this spot, sees this layer of soot, they find a piece of 1700 BC pottery. He knows. He's a ceramic typologist. He knows instantly what it is, what time it's from, whatever. So this is the era, right? He looks at it, he flips it over, and it's got this green glassy glaze. And he says, this technology didn't exist for 2,400 years. It didn't exist in 1700 BC. It began to exist in the 8th century. The Muslims invented this kind of stuff. How can I find this glassy glaze on something that's from 1700 BC? They take it to a lab in New Mexico. And, I mean, these things have now been looked at by many labs. But when he first finds it, he takes it to this lab. And the folks in the lab say, this pottery is itself melted. It had to be exposed to something like 4,000 degrees for like 25 seconds. And the only thing that could do that is what they call a cosmic airburst event, which is like a meteor coming 35,000 miles an hour into the atmosphere.
A space rock had to hit it.
Okay. So that happened in 1908 in Tunguska, Siberia. That's why today we have some metrics where we can say, okay, it looks like what happened in 1908 in Siberia that flattened 80 million trees in an instant. That must have happened here in 1700 BC. So the scientists determined that this was like an atomic bomb. It was the equivalent of 1,000 Hiroshima bombs, at least, oh, maybe twice as many. It's just incomprehensible. So in the Nature article, not only, do I write about this in my book, there's a chapter in Is Atheism Dead where I go into this, but the recent article in Nature on an extremely, you don't want to reread it because it's extremely technical, but they come to the same conclusion at the end of this intensely technical, detailed scientific analysis. They say, hard not to believe that, the stories of Sodom did not emerge from here because everything lines up.
So you're kind of left to that same dilemma of when researchers talk about Exodus and how, it's entire, like an eclipse may have blocked out the sun. And I almost feel you get both options. So the secular scientists could say, well, yeah, the space rock collision could have inspired the biblical story, or the Christian could say, well, or guess what? The Bible accurately depicted this and now science is confirming it. So either one of those is a tenable position on this one.
Well, I think I think there's no way, obviously, in a scientific journal of the prestige of nature, you know, that they can go past where they went. But where they went is incredibly far. I mean, it's very dramatic.
And is this recent? If people want to go look this up, how recent is the Nature Journal article?
This was September 20th, 2021. This is what? This is 9 days ago.
9 days ago. Wow. So this is breaking news, essentially.
ten days ago. It came out from when we're talking, and I just wrote an article that's going to be in Newsweek on Monday, kind of summing this up. But I cannot tell you. I mean, the more you know, the more astonishing it is. And by the way, there's no way the accuracy of the Bible is what is kind of freaky. The man who discovered biblical Sodom, this archaeologist Stephen Collins, he found the spot by reading exactly what it says in Genesis and saying, if this place is real and if it could ever be discovered, it has to be here because that's what Genesis says. So the scientists doing all this research and all this stuff, they wouldn't have any stuff to do research on
if
Stephen Collins had not used Genesis as a guidebook to find this spot. So
is Collins a person of faith?
He is. Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's
but was fact, he, b- before he did this. Before he did this, was he a person of faith, or did he did this?
No, he was a person of faith. Okay. Yeah. And it was because of his belief that the Bible is true that he said where others had said Sodom and Gomorrah probably were. It didn't make sense. He was leading a tour. I mean, I write about this in the book. He was leading a tour of the Holy Land, and one of the things was to say they say Sodom and Gomorrah probably around this area, and he just said, you know, it doesn't make sense, and he started digging into it, and he says,
no pun intended,
it's gotta be here. And son of a gun, it was exactly where the Bible says it is. And you think, well, is that just coincidence? I mean, it gets pretty heavy. It's pretty
and
cool
that's stuff. Not and I obviously I know we have to kind of go lightning round this because we got to get you out on a time to, you know, less important podcast, but that's a fascinating anecdote. You have another one in there I found interesting about Jesus's childbirth home.
This I almost don't want to talk about this because this sounds—
Give us a teaser, though, because it screams of, I don't want to call cover up, but it is interesting that along the historical records, these things get omitted.
This is what I love. And I think when you're young, at least when I was younger, I just thought that everything that's true comes out and everything works. And then you start realizing, no, we're living in a fallen world. And a lot of times the truth is hidden forever. And you don't discover it till some guy stumbles on something, whatever. Well, I was doing the research for this book. I'd never heard of some of this stuff. And as I'm doing the research, I thought, you know, I want to write about biblical Sodom and I want to write about some other major archaeological finds. So I want to kind of give my reader, you know, kind of a soup to nuts primer on the basics of biblical archaeology because it's incredibly impressive. I mean, the stuff they have found, the home in Capernaum of Peter. Now, again, that sounds crazy. It's not.
Is it an Airbnb now, by the way?
Yes, it is. Okay. No, it's but what's funny is that we can't imagine that these places could still exist. But what happens, and I, you know, the more I looked into this, I thought this makes sense. In antiquity, you can imagine that the first followers of Jesus would have instantly made sacred shrines of any of the places. I mean, the house where he grew up, the house where his mother grew up, the house where Peter lived in Capernaum, these places, the place where Jesus was born in Bethlehem, this was all within living memory. I mean, this was, you know, while this persecution's going on, they consider these places really holy. And that memory survived. In fact, the Romans tried to crush it, tried to wipe these places out. They would build temples of Roman pagan temples over these sacred sites. So by building a Roman pagan temple to desecrate the holy site, they were inadvertently preserving it and marking it and saying, yeah, this is the spot. This is where Jesus was born. This is where Jesus was buried. This is where, you know. So in Nazareth, in 1880, some French nuns moved to Nazareth from France to build a convent in Nazareth. They're the Sisters of Jesus or the Sisters of Nazareth. They built a convent, and the spot they picked, they were doing some excavation and they came upon what looked like an ancient church. Long story short, in 2006, an archaeologist, an English archaeologist, University of Reading, starts an actual excavation, so tremendously recently, and doesn't publish on it until a few months ago, the fall of 2020, a year ago, publishes a book with all the findings. What did they find? They found a church. They found another church on top of the church. Now, why would people in the fourth century, in the sixth century, why would they build huge churches in a place like Nazareth? Well, traditionally, they would build them over a sacred site. In the 700s, in the 8th century, the Muslims took over that area and destroyed these churches. So there's no record. 13 centuries pass, or 12 centuries pass, before these women build this convent, and then another 150 years before somebody very recently digs in it. So they find a Byzantine-era church, they find a Crusader-era church, and what do they find beneath these two churches? A first century dwelling in Nazareth. There's a memory. I write about the details in the book. I hope people will, dig into it. But there's no question that the reason these huge churches were built too over this spot was to mark it as a sacred site, and that the Muslims destroyed these churches and people forgot about it until they happened to be discovered in 1880 by these nuns, and it kind of carried along in fits and starts until it's finally excavated. But it's literally not until 1 year ago, even less, that the publication comes out. And the publication almost seems ashamed. And so they talk about Byzantine and Crusader era churches, whatever. You feel like saying, hey, you're describing boxes. Tell me what's in the box, like a diamond. Why aren't you describing? The only reason the boxes exist, the only reason these churches exist, is to cover and to preserve what's at the bottom, which is this first century home in Nazareth. Anyway, it's crazy. It's hard to believe. It's like saying, they just discovered a Noah's Ark, and then the next week they discovered Santa's workshop at the North Pole. No kidding. Let's look at it. I mean, it doesn't seem possible.
And we have not found Noah's Ark or Santa's workshop yet, right?
Not that I know of, no.
That's your follow-up book, right? Is the search for Santa?
It's just, yeah. It's so crazy. When I looked into this, I thought to myself, how do I, Eric Metaxas, get to write about this? How is it that I'm writing about this and that nobody knows about this? It just happened to be that I was looking into recent biblical archaeology a year ago when I was writing this book. And I came upon this and I said, am I dreaming? This is like the greatest news ever. This is man lands on moon news. I mean, if they've discovered the home of Jesus, Mary, and Joseph, how does it get bigger than that? I cannot even believe I'm saying this to you. But, something was published on it in biblical archaeology about 5 years ago, and then nothing. The book was published more recently, but it's comedy. This is comedy. I want the world to know all this stuff.
Book is filled with these. I mean, I've spent hours poring over another Metaxas tome this morning. And folks, these are two stories that I just kind of stuck out to me that I found fascinating. But you did your homework. How long did it take you to write this one?
Hours. Many, many hours.
Oh, okay. So like 3 or 4.
It's like a long weekend. My staff works on it. I just kind of sign off on it.
That's right. You just kind of head in there.
Actually,
also,
the funny thing is I don't use researchers. The only time I've ever had help is on my book, Seven Men and Seven Women. All my other books, I write every syllable, I do all the research. I can't really work with others. I just have to do it myself. But it's a huge labor. I mean, I don't even know. I never keep track of how long, but I want it to be right. I don't want anybody to say, we found, this error, that error. I want to find errors in other people's books. I don't want people to find errors in my book. So I'm very careful. And I think, that's important. I care.
Last question is archaeology here. I'm curious, for those who might study this, because this is just the claims you're making in this and just reporting on, I mean, these are astounding. Would you say that has any of these discoveries moved the needle as far as, I don't know if you you strike me as someone who has multiple friends who are biblical archaeologists, but I'm curious, are they overwhelmingly people of faith then? Or I would wonder in that field, if you're studying, if that would lead you to If you've met many or in this research.
The answer to that is I honestly don't know. The two that I do know are men of faith, but I don't know that many that I can comment on that.
It's interesting because you think if you're, you know, you're studying, whether you go into archaeology, probably because you have an interest in faith, period. But if the Bible is seemingly always being used as the main go-to, like, starter to go find all this stuff, at what point will enough discoveries be made that we go, this book is at least somewhat historically accurate?
That, and we're already at that point. If you deny it at this point, you're just sticking your head in the sand. I'm sorry, but that's a fact. People need to be shaken up. This is the most the discovery of biblical Sodom, the details, what they write about in Nature, which, as I said, my article in Newsweek touches on it, but the chapter in the book gives you more more details. And I just interviewed the archaeologist on my program yesterday. Wow. I guess it's very important that we understand that our faith is rational, and I can tell you this much: atheism is irrational. Now, again, you can't prove Christianity, but don't tell me it's not rational, and don't tell me atheism is rational. Based on what we know from science and from other things that I talk about in the end of the book, I think you have to retire atheism and you have to move to agnosticism if you want to be intellectually fulfilled.
Amazing. Well, give us one last look at the book so we can encourage everyone to check it out.
There you go.
Is Atheism Dead by Eric Metaxas? Is that a snake? And can you give us a little, what's the commentary on the cover there?
It's a snake swallowing its own tail. And I think it's kind of that's the glyph. That's the kind of idea, is that bad ideas consume themselves eventually. They can't sustain themselves. So a snake swallowing its own tail, that concept comes up a few times in the book. So I don't want to give it away, but you'll see.
Oh yeah. Well, all right. Well, Eric Metaxas, thank you.
People, please go to my website where you can pre-order the book. We need people to pre-order it. I'm begging you. There are great prices. Really, it's 45% off the hardcover, which is like unheard of. So please take advantage of it and check it out. Thank you.
So we're going to ericmetaxas.com, right?
Please.
That's right. We'll send everybody there. So anyways, folks, you've been listening to Kinda Christian with Eric Metaxas, who is anything but kinda Christian. So Eric, thank you so much for being here and all the research you've done. And I hope you'll come back and see us soon.
I'd love to. It's fun talking to you, and I'm sorry I have to run, but I do. But we'll talk again, Ryan. God bless you, man. Thank you.
Hey, thank you so much. Folks, we'll talk to you soon. God bless everybody.